One of the hardest things to live through is the sudden, unexpected death of someone you love. When Juan Thompson was 41 years old, his father committed suicide. He's had a decade to cope and try to come to terms with it. But for him, there's a complicating factor. His father was Hunter S. Thompson, the famous gonzo journalist, the author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He was a writer with a huge, oversized reputation for hard living, for drugs and alcohol and violence. And so grief is complicated enough when it's private, but when the person you miss was a public figure with a big reputation, it can be a lot harder to navigate. Now, Juan Thompson has written a book of his own. It's called Stories I Tell Myself, and it's about his complicated relationship with his father. He told Charles Monroe Kane that despite their shared last name, he and his dad could not have been more different.
He had a lot of shortcomings as a father, but he really, really wanted to have a connection with me. And I wanted to have a connection with him. And that was really the key, that we just kept trying, you know, and didn't give up, even through the many, many examples when we just were not talking the same language.
It seems you have a real hard thing to deal with. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people I know grew up with an alcoholic or drug-addicted parent. But those people didn't, their father wasn't a legend for doing those things. That must make it harder for you because people are like, yeah, he parties, he was awesome. But you're like, that's the stuff that made him not the best father.
I mean, that's what motivated me to write the book in the first place.
Right.
All of the coverage of Hunter after he died really focused on, you know, that Raoul Duke wild man persona. And that really bothered me because it was so one-dimensional, but also it completely missed the point of Hunter's, you know, real contributions.
Are you like your father at all? The drugs, the drinking, guns? I mean, is that the anger? Are you like him?
I've been asked that question a lot recently, and you know, the simple answer is my father and I are really different people. And I think that's part of what made it so difficult for us to find a way to connect. Part of it was you know, me observing the chaos that he just created and, you know, followed him around like this cloud. And I really didn't want to, you know, to have that. So I think a part of my personality was kind of formed in opposition to his. You know, I prefer being in control. I don't like not into drugs, you know, very minimal drinking. And it's just so many other ways. I mean, he was a very typically, you know, masculine macho guy.
Right.
And I am definitely not that.
I'd like to ask you, I know you just wrote a memoir, so it's strange for me to preface this question by saying, hope you don't mind if I ask a personal question, but
yeah,
I would like to ask you a personal question, and it's from the book, but it's a difficult question, so it's uncomfortable to ask, but I want to ask about it because I think it's really powerful and very important. Can you tell me about what happened in February of 2005 with your son and your wife and your father?
Sure. Obviously, thought about it a lot, and I wrote about it, and so I've had plenty of time to process it. I mean, basically what happened is that my wife and son and I went up to see him one weekend in Whitty Creek, and we were just having a very nice weekend. He seemed calmer and more present than usual. It was just he and I for a while, you know, like 4 a.m. or something. And he said, you know, you might want to take some of these, you know, family heirlooms with you. And being denser in denial, I said, well, okay, you know, is there something I should know? You know, and thank God he said no, you know. And the next day, my wife and son were in the living room. Hunter was in the kitchen. I was in a little guest bedroom doing something, and I just heard this like a bang, but it was more like a crack, like, you know, he had dropped a dictionary or something big and heavy had hit the floor. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd, but with Hunter, you know, anything's possible. So I came out of the guest bedroom to finish what I was doing and just looked over, you know, at Hunter, and he was just sitting there in his chair with his chin in his chest. And I thought, well, that's strange. Is he asleep? And then I thought, oh my gosh, has he had a seizure of some kind? And I walked over toward him, and then, you know, it really just started to creep into my brain that, no, you know, he was dead. As I walked over to him, I probably saw, you know, saw some blood and the gun, and it was funny. I mean, there was very little blood. I think probably most people, when they hear someone has shot themselves, imagine, you know, blood and gore everywhere, but there was hardly any blood at all. But as I realized what had actually happened, it was just, it was just terrifying. I just remember this cold chill going over my whole body. I panicked, you know, I just couldn't think straight. I just kind of lost it. Went to get my, you know, wife to tell her what had happened. My son never actually saw Hunter's body, but he was in the living room, I'm sure, wondering what terrible thing has happened. Because I'm sure he saw his parents upset and frightened in a way that he had never seen us before. And then, of course, you know, the police come and all these people are coming in. So I know it was very difficult for him, even though he never actually saw the body. And then, of course, Hunter being, you know, famous, there was all this attention. It wasn't just a person committing suicide. It was a very well-known person. So then we had the media and the phone calls and reporters and the news trucks down the road just amplified, you know, all of it. You know, surreal and really difficult.
Why do you think he did it while you were there, while his grandson was there? Why did you think he did that?
I think because, he had decided, because of his health issues, the fact that he was, his body was, you know, breaking down, he didn't have the mobility. He didn't have the same control of his body. That was just not tolerable to him. So that was one factor. I think he saw that he really couldn't write anymore. He didn't have the concentration to be able to finish even something short. And I believe that writing was the most important thing to my father. More important than family, for sure. And then he was also in a very, very difficult marriage to his, you know, new wife. And I think those three factors, he decided, I'm done. These are things that cannot be fixed. So I'm out of here. And I think he chose that weekend for a couple of reasons. First, because he was with people who really loved him and didn't want anything from him. And I think it was like this, you know, this bubble of comfort for him. And I think second, I think he probably wanted me to deal with the aftermath of finding his body and, you know, calling the sheriff and just dealing with those practicalities, that he wanted it to be me rather than, you know, somebody else. Now, that may not be true, but you know, like we were talking about earlier. These are
this the stories is, you tell yourself.
This is the story I've made up, yeah.
How do you, what about you, Juan? Not your dad. You're there with your kid and your wife. How do you, I mean, I read your book. It seems very likely from reading how you tell it that it seems like he did do that on purpose to create even a bond between the two of you after his death. That's pretty manipulative. How do you feel about that happening?
Well, I mean, he was a manipulative person in the sense that there were very, very few things he said or did that were not calculated, you know, to create a certain outcome. I have chosen to see it as a compliment in the sense that he trusted me to be that person. I think he was, well, he was in a lot of pain and he was, you know, a fairly self-centered person. I don't think he really thought through how that would impact my son. Yeah, it's so hard to say. I wish he hadn't done it because he was in so much pain and it just made sense for him to do that. But, you know, if I could have reconstructed it, I really would have, I would have much preferred it if my son hadn't been there and, you know, had been more distant from the whole scene. Or just something he heard about and he didn't have to experience all that chaos.
But you didn't say you would...
First person.
In that scenario, you just said you didn't say you wouldn't prefer that he didn't do it. You just preferred that it would have been done differently.
Yes. Yes, because, you know, for him, it just made sense. I mean, there was no alternative. What was he going to do, you know, live in a nursing home? You know, that's just inconceivable for him, being the kind of person he was, who valued his independence. That just wasn't going to happen. He's going to, you know, like go in the hospital and die in the hospital over 3 months. I mean, that would be even worse. Right. So to relieve his own suffering, I wouldn't change that. But, you know, again, I wish my son hadn't been there.
You know, we're talking about your son, your father. Your father was a father, right? What lessons do you take from him, good and bad? Like as a father, being like, okay, I'm not going to ever do that to my son. Or, yeah, no, that's good. I want my son to learn that kind of thing. What do you take from him?
That's a good question. I'd say the, you know, the positive things, I think, are things that a lot of people take from Hunter, which is his, they're inspired by his, you know, his emphasis on, you know, freedom from convention, from social norms, freedom from the sense of, well, this is what you should do. And he was very focused on not, you know, do what makes you feel good, but do what is right for you. And I think that's a really important thing. And that's something I really hope my son, you know, takes to heart is when he's making decisions about his life that he's not constrained by, well, this is, you know, this is what most people do, or this is what I should do, but really thinks, you know, what do I want to do? What do I feel compelled to do? And I suppose just, I mean, he could be, you know, very self-centered, and I've really tried to forgive him mm-hmm. for that, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to have that connection. And again, I'm just, you know, so glad that we were able to do that while he was alive rather than trying to work it out after he died.
That's Juan Thompson talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Juan's memoir is called Stories I Tell Myself, Growing Up with Hunter S. Thompson.